following presentation is brought to you by Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed. Delivering today's message will be Dr. Richard Bacon.
We've begun to do number 154 in the larger catechism. And basically what that talks about is the means by which Christ communicates the benefits of redemption to us. And what we've done is just kind of as a preliminary study, because this speaks of the Word, sacraments, and prayer, we've begun talking about one of the worship elements that we use that is a part of the Word, but it's not specifically listed here, and that's the singing of psalms. The answer is that the outward and ordinary means whereby Christ communicates to his church the benefits of his mediation are all his ordinances, especially the word, sacraments, and prayer, all which are made effectual to the elect for their salvation. And as we begun talking about psalmody, I mentioned last week, or 2 weeks ago, whenever we did this last, that I had attended a conference in which the issue of exclusive psalmody was being debated. And I can't remember now exactly what I said or how I characterized it, but I would say that the person who took our position lost the debate, not on the merits of the argument, in my opinion, but simply because he apparently just isn't used to debating. There were a number of objections that were raised, questions that were raised that he didn't really address. And one of those questions had to do with the imprecatory psalms, so-called imprecatory psalms. I'm going to put that word on the board for you. An imprecatory psalm is one that calls down a curse. Okay, the verb to imprecate means to curse someone or something. So an imprecatory psalm would be a cursing psalm. I have an answer here that hopefully I'm going to do more than just read it to you, but if it gets a little bit like it's being read, it's because I've written it as an essay. I thought maybe we'd run it in the Blue Banner or Credo Quarterly or something like that. Here's the way I have worded the objection. Some psalms are imprecations against the wicked. But Christ now teaches us to love our enemies and even to pray for them. It is therefore opposite a Christian spirit to sing such psalms as call for the destruction of the wicked or our enemies. Okay, I phrased it as a statement because I want it to sound like an objection rather than a question. Because even though sometimes it is set forth as a question, it's not a request for information. It's a, well, that's dumb, isn't it, kind of a question. In other words, it's not requesting information. Yes, don't you agree that that's dumb? But rather it's an assertion with a question mark at the end. You understand the difference? So that's the reason I've stated it as a sentence, as a declaration, because it's really an objection. And what is the objection? Well, the objection is that since we're to love our enemies, it's against a Christian spirit to sing that God would curse them. Now, what do you think about that? What's the answer? Nuh-uh. Right? The answer is nuh-uh. That's the theological answer? Okay, well, what's the biblical answer? Now that we've got the theology out of the way. Well, first of all, let me say this. There are so many problems with the objection, it's hard to know where to begin. Perhaps the best place to begin is with the fact that biblical ethics are absolute. There is no such thing as an Old Testament ethic in which it was okay to curse your enemies, and now in the New Testament, that ethic has changed. Okay, so that's our first answer. Again, I'm going to put it up here on the board for you. Ethics are absolute. What we mean by that is that if it's wrong for us to curse our enemies, then it was always wrong to curse our enemies. This didn't just suddenly start with the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, usually the Sermon on the Mount at Matthew 5 in the 30s, you have heard it said, love your enemy and hate your... Love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies and pray for those who despitefully use you. Now, where in the Bible do we read love your neighbor and hate your enemy? Nowhere. That's a scribal gloss. The Bible does not teach that anywhere. So the biblical ethic required the believer in David's day, that is to say, when the psalm was written, when the psalms were written, the Bible ethic required the believer in David's day to do good to his personal enemies as much as it requires the same of Christians today. And so David did. Turn with me to 1 Samuel 26, verses 23 through 25. Chris, I'm not sure what version of this I finally ended up emailing to you, but I'll do some more fixing in the next few days, and we're not going to have this in the second quarter anyway, right? Can't squeeze it all into one page? Okay. What did I say? 2 Samuel? I meant 1 Samuel. First Samuel 26, starting at verse 23. The Lord render to every man his... Well, I'll start at verse 21. Here's what's going on. What's going on is that Saul has been pursuing David in the wilderness. And David has an opportunity to kill Saul. He's in a cave. David has an opportunity to kill him. This is the second time. The first time was in Gedi. This is the second time this has happened. He has an opportunity to kill him. Doesn't do it. Then said Saul, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do thee harm, because my soul was precious in thine eyes this day. Behold, I have played the fool, and have erred exceedingly. And David answered and said, behold the king's spear, and let one of the young men come over and fetch it. The Lord render to every man his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered thee into my hand today. But I would not stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed. So here we have David being confronted with his enemy. Not only a perceived enemy, but someone who was seeking his life. And what did he do? He spared him, didn't he? He returned his life to him. And behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of the Lord. And let him deliver me out of all tribulation. Then Saul said to David, blessed be thou, my son David. Thou shalt do great things and also shalt prevail. So David went on his way and Saul returned to his place. So, even though we find Psalms in which David cries out to God to destroy this wicked person or that wicked person, when it comes down to his ability, his own ability to destroy Saul, he didn't do it. In other words, the imprecatory psalms are not about personal vengeance. That was not David's spirit, nor is it to be our spirit today. So the first thing for the Christian to address in singing the imprecatory psalms is that he is not speaking to God about his own personal enemies. Okay, we're not singing to God, we're not praising God and saying, oh God, destroy my boss. We're not saying, God, give me permission to kill my boss while I'm at work tomorrow. The law required that an Israelite should treat the stranger according to the same law as the homeborn. Furthermore, not only did God forbid his people from vexing a stranger, he positively required them to do good to them. Thus the Bible teaches in Exodus 22 Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. At Exodus 23, 4 and 5, if thou meet thine enemy's ox or his ass going astray, thou shalt surely bring it back to him again. If thou see the ass of him that hateth thee lying under his burden and wouldest forbear to help him, thou shalt surely help with him. And Proverbs 25, 21 and 22, which is quoted in Romans chapter 12, if thine enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. If he be thirsty, give him water to drink, for thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head, and the Lord shall reward thee. Here's what I want you to understand. The ethic in the Old Testament was to love and pray for our enemies as much as it is in the New Testament. The ethic of God has not changed. If the ethic of the psalm is sub-Christian, then it's also sub-biblical. It's sub-Old Testament. It's below the Old Testament religion as surely as it's below the New Testament religion, if it's sub-Christian, something that we're going to deny. But the first thing I want to do is reduce it to the absurd. I want you to see that not only is it not against a Christian ethic, it's not against... If we were singing against our personal enemies, it would have been wrong for David to write it, much less for us to sing it. Well, the way I said it was, as call for the destruction of the wicked or our enemies. So I've tried to encompass both, because you'll hear it both ways. So, it's absolutely necessary that when we're singing the Psalms, that we have some basic understanding of Christian ethics. But our ethic is very much different from the dispensationalism that's presupposed by this objection. And not just, you know, people throw around the word dispensationalism routinely anytime you want to make a distinction between Old and New Testament. Not every distinction between Old and New Testament is dispensationalism. The church has for 2,000 years now been making distinctions between Old and New Testaments. That's why we say Old and New. Dispensationalism makes a distinction in the ethic between the Old and New Testaments. They say that the ethic of the Old Testament is law, the ethic of the New Testament is love. And they fit those two things at odds with one another. Yes, when he said, I'm going to make David sing like a Christian. That's right. Unquestionably, there are distinctions to be maintained between the Old Testament and the New, between law and gospel, and between works and grace. However, the gospel is the same in both testaments. The law is the same in both testaments, and morality is the same in both testaments. So far, are the Psalms from commending a sub-Christian morality that they teach conduct of the highest and purest standards. So that was answer one. Answer number two to this objection is that the ethics teach a much higher morality than most of the songs that are being sung in the churches today. Most of the songs that are being sung in the churches today are extremely man-centered and don't I feel good now oriented, related. Whereas the Psalms are what we say theocentric. In other words, they center on God's personal attributes and how we should live in accordance with them. So, the purpose of the Psalms is not, strictly speaking, to teach morality. We're not saying that that's the purpose of the Psalms. However, when the Psalms bless one course of conduct, one course of speech, one course of thought against another, it's always the higher one that it commends. It's always the higher one that it blesses. It does not bless low conduct. It does not bless filthy speech. It does not bless stealing. When the pagans of old were still struggling to adopt some speculative notion of good and true, there was already a Hebrew poetry in the Psalms that taught the good and the true. And I would say today that any nation that would adopt the moral principles that it finds in the Psalter will be a nation famous for its justice and mercy. The Psalter inculcates a righteous ethic because of its conception and presentation of God and His attributes. No book of the Bible, and certainly no uninspired hymnody, gives a more complete understanding of God's perfections. I remember being told years and years ago that I should never derive any doctrine from the Psalter. Well, I can understand why the person said that. You know, he was wrong, but the reason he said it was because he didn't like the doctrines that he found in the Psalter. It's only as men have the glory of God as the purpose of their actions that any action can rightly be called good. In other words, when the U.S. government just went over to Iraq and disrupted their society, you have a nation that allows abortion going in and invading a nation that doesn't allow abortion. You have a nation that promotes homosexuality invading a nation that will not allow homosexuality. So the idea that actions are good, in other words, simply denying homosexuality, simply denying abortion so-called rights, is not in itself morality. It's not in itself a good act. If they were, then we'd have to say that the government of Iraq was a good government. Do you understand the problem? The reason we do not say that it was a good government, the reason that we do not say that they could be a good government, is because the purpose is not to glorify God. That is to say, the glory of God is not the purpose of their actions. It's self-righteousness. So then, men's thoughts, conversations, and deeds are all under the influence of the way in which they think of God. If we think of God one way, our thoughts, deeds, and actions will reflect that. If we think of God a different way, our thoughts, deeds, and actions will reflect that. God's character is displayed in greater manifest glory in the inspired words of the Psalter than in the compositions that originate in the human heart, regardless of how pious that heart may be. The manifest glory of God is displayed more clearly in the Psalter than it can be in an uninspired hymn, no matter how pious the hymn writer may be. We're not suggesting that people who write hymns, people who write songs to glorify God are not pious. We're simply saying that they cannot correctly manifest the glory of God to the extent that the Psalter does. The Psalter presses God's law upon the psyche in such a way that singers cannot lightly dismiss or contemn its message. The standard of righteousness and justice by which men may evaluate every system of ethics is the character of God, revealed in His moral law and celebrated in the Psalter. In addition, the Psalms, like the law of God itself, are extremely broad. The ethics of the Psalter touch upon the whole life of man. Get your Psalters out and you can go through this with me. Integrity. Now, I'm not going to challenge most of you to come up with uninspired hymnody because, I'll be quite frank with you, I don't know very much. And I wouldn't encourage you to either. But I want you to see the extent I want you to see the extent to which the Psalter sets forth a very high ideal of morality. In Psalm 7 and verse 8, "The Lord, He shall the people judge, my judge Jehovah be, after my righteousness and mine integrity in me." Now that's calling down an airstrike on your own position, isn't it? It is requiring of the singer a degree of integrity, isn't it? In Psalm 26:11, "But as for me, I will walk on in mine integrity, Do thou redeem me, and O Lord, be merciful unto me. Integrity, benevolence. Psalm 41:1. Blessed is he that wisely doth the poor man's case consider. For when the time of trouble is, the Lord will him deliver. Psalm 112:9. He hath dispersed, given to the poor. His righteousness shall be to ages all. With honor shall his horn be raised high. Regard for authority. Psalm 21:5. In that salvation wrought by thee, his glory is made great. Honor and comely majesty thou hast upon him set. Obedience to God's law. Psalm 119, 9 and 15. Some of you must figure on getting the tape later. By what means shall a young man learn his way to purify, if he according to thy word thereto attentive be? I will thy holy precepts make my meditation, and carefully I'll have respect unto thy ways each one. Love for the brethren. Behold how good a thing it is, and how becoming well together such as brethren are in unity to dwell. Psalm 133, 1. Love for enemies. Psalm 7, 4 and 5. If I rewarded ill to him that was at peace with me, yea, even the man that without cause my foe was, I did free, then let the foe pursue and take my soul, and my life thrust down to the earth, and let him lay mine honor in the dust. Doesn't sound like we're supposed to hate our enemies, does it? Returning good for evil. Psalm 35, 13 and 14. But as for me, when they were sick, in sackcloth sad I mourned. My humbled soul did fast, my prayer into my bosom turned. Myself I did behave as he had been my friend or brother. I heavily bowed down as one that mourneth for his mother. Home life, purity of thought and speech, all of these things have the perfect standard set for us in the Psalter, because the standard that's set in the Psalter is God's law. So, here's my point. So far is the Psalter from teaching a sub-Christian ethic that most of the songs that other people sing don't even come close. In fact, most of the songs that are sung in the churches today come down to a single line. Oh, don't I want to feel good? Now, they may express it 100 different ways, but that's what most of them come down to. They're man-centered. But did you notice that the Psalms that I just quoted to you, if you're not living those lives, should bring conviction, shouldn't they? So it's clear then that we could multiply examples. We could turn to almost any psalm. We could almost open the Psalter at random and pick a page, and there's going to be an ethic there that's higher than we can live up to. So it's far from being a sub-Christian ethic. But that's not the purpose of the discussion this afternoon. The point, rather, is that in demonstrating the high morality of the Psalter, Christians should understand that the Psalter does not incite us to anything sinful, including hating our enemies. Right? In fact, the term imprecatory may even be somewhat misleading. I went ahead and put it up there because that's what we call them. But these psalms do not call down curses merely for the sake of cursing. Rather, they are appeals to God's justice for him to act justly. Thus, if one calls them justice psalms, much of the prejudice against them can be removed just by calling them what they are and not what they aren't. Besides, there's no reason to see spiritual harm coming to the singer of these psalms any more than to the reader of them. Right? Am I going to harm myself by singing an imprecatory psalm? Then I would harm myself just as much by reading it. The confession of my confession is that all of the canonical psalms are given by inspiration of God. And as such, they are profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, truly furnished unto all good works. 2 Timothy. The fact that David wrote such psalms by inspiration of God should settle the fact, then, that they are profitable to the church for the same reasons that all Holy Scripture is profitable. Right? If they're inspired, then they're profitable for what? For doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. Further, the language of the New Testament, reason three. The language of the New Testament is no more mellow. It's not as though we move to the New Testament and all of a sudden everybody's lovey-dovey and can't say enough good things about one another. John the Baptist, O generation of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? That's an imprecation. Matthew 3:7, Luke 3:7. The same term was used by lowly Jesus, meek and mild, at Matthew 12:34 and 23:33, referring to the Pharisees as a generation of vipers. That's right, lowly Jesus, meek and mild. That's his first name. His last name is Christ. Well, the point being this, that when Jesus spoke to the Pharisees, when he spoke to those who needed to have imprecations called down upon them, he didn't hesitate. Was he meek and mild toward those who received him with gladness? Absolutely he was. But he was not meek and mild toward the Pharisees. Read Matthew 23, and that will disabuse you of that idea in a hurry. The Apostle Peter cursed Simon Magus when he said, "Thy money perish with thee." He didn't say, "Oh, I hope your money perishes, but that you repent and turn to God." He said what? "Thy money perish with thee." Is that a curse or not? Sounds like one. In fact, it sounds a whole lot more like an imprecation than anything you'll find in the Psalms. Except maybe against Ahithophel or Doeg. He pronounced a similar judgment on Ananias and Sapphira, recorded in Acts chapter 5. Then again. Yeah, remember that? Sapphira walks in, they're just carrying Ananias out. He says, "You have anything you want to tell me about the money?" Yeah. The Apostle Paul cursed, or anathematized, if you prefer, which is simply the Greek for curse. He anathematized all those who preach false gospels. Galatians 1, 8, and 9. He instructed that an incestuous man be delivered to Satan. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And he prayed that God would reward Alexander the coppersmith according to his evil works. The saints under the altar, in Revelation chapter 6, cried out, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on earth?" So far is this prayer from a sinful desire that the author of Hebrews refers to such souls as the spirits of just men made perfect. None of the expressed judgments or pleas for justice in the New Testament arose from sentiments of personal revenge. And it is a false sense of superiority that would suppose that the expressed judgments and pleas for justice in the Psalms do arise from such a spirit. Right? Why would people think that? Only a false sense of superiority. What was that, number three? Number four, I want to look at a special case. Psalm 137:9. "Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones." Probably one of the most maligned of the Psalms. But Calvin commented this way. I'm going to quote to you now from some of you have heard of John Calvin. "As God had determined to punish Babylon, he pronounced a blessing upon Cyrus and Darius, while on the other hand, Jeremiah, in 48:10, declares those cursed who should do the work of the Lord negligently, that is, fail in strenuously carrying out the work of desolation and destruction, which God had called them as his hired executioners. It may seem to savor of cruelty that he should wish the tender and innocent infants to be dashed and mangled upon the stones, but he does not speak under the impulse of personal feeling, and only employs words which God had himself authorized, so that this is but the declaration of a just judgment, as when our Lord says, "With what measure you meet, it shall be measured to you again." Matthew 7:2. In fact, that's exactly what's going on, because the people that this is going to happen to, according to Psalm 137, are the very ones who dashed the heads of the Israelites' children against the stones in the destruction of Jerusalem. So what is the psalmist praying in Psalm 137:9? With what measure you meet, may it be measured to you again. Which is the same words that lowly Jesus meek and mild. Another problem with the objection against singing justice psalms arises from the fact, number five. Okay, that was a special case. Now, number five. Another problem with the objection against singing justice psalms arises from the fact that King David was in great measure not only a man after God's heart, but a type and spokesman of Christ. The imprecation of the psalms are therefore most often expressions of the infinite justice of the God-man. They express Christ's righteous indignation against wrongdoers and his righteous compassion for the wronged. That's another thing that we need to remember, is that these justice psalms are normally speaking on behalf of those who have been wronged. They represent the attitude, his attitude, Christ's attitude, as the king and defender of his church. You know, that's the kind of defender we want, isn't it? The kind of defender that's going to get the bullies off our necks. These psalms reveal the depths of Christ's love for the church and of his hatred for sin. Not in the abstract, but he hates sin as it exists in sinners. And as a result, he doesn't cry out, "Oh God, destroy the sin, but love the sinner." What does he say? Destroy the sinner. Sin does not exist apart from sinners, does it? Sin doesn't just hang out there in the air somewhere. There is no such abstract as sin. Sin is always committed by sinners. These psalms reveal the depths of Christ's love for the church, and Christ himself is the best key to understanding the psalms. And the imprecatory psalms are no exception to this general rule. Further, there is an implicit exhortation not to be one of those against whom the church sings. Such psalms teach their singers to love justice and hate iniquity, to do good and to eschew evil. I'm going to quote another man, Reverend J.H. Webster of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, stated this: "It must be obvious to the attentive student of the imprecatory psalms that their effect is to restrain us from sin, to make us love and value justice, to lead us to commit vengeance into the hands of the Lord, thus strongly deterring us from private and personal vengeance, and to show us that God is to be praised for his justice as well as for his mercy." History itself teaches us that civilization progresses most rapidly when justice and mercy go hand in hand in the conduct of affairs, as they do in the scriptures of God. As I tell the children of the church I pastor, when you sing the imprecatory psalms, make sure you're not standing on the bullseye. Prayer for the overthrow of the wicked is sinful only insofar as it may arise from sentiments of private ill will or revenge, or from a desire for gain or success based on the failure of others. When that prayer proceeds from a love of justice, for the protection of the innocent, for the peace of society, for the vindication of the righteous, for the encouragement of the virtuous, for the spread of the gospel, and for the honor of God, it's a just prayer. Aversion to the imprecatory psalms may arise in some from a misunderstood or misguided idea of mercy, but there are many for whom the aversion arises from a misunderstanding or contempt for God's justice. If men had greater contempt for sin, they would have correspondingly less contempt for the psalms of God's justice. Finally, where are we? Eight? I've lost count. Seven? All right. Finally, it is not broad charity that refuses to sing of the justice and judgment of God, but a narrow and man-centered humanism. The church in Scripture cries to God for justice and judgment, while the church today expects and longs for peace at any price. Those who consider the judgment God brought upon Babylon in Psalm 137, for example, to belong to a former, less gracious age, should consider that it was the merchants of the world, that is, the worldlings, who wept and mourned over Babylon in the New Testament book of Revelation. But for God's people, the command from heaven remains, as in Revelation chapter 18, "Rejoice over her," that is, over her destruction, "thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all. And the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and of trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth." Now you see, that's a New Testament ethic. That's a New Testament prayer, and it's a commanded prayer. We are commanded to rejoice over the fall and destruction of Babylon. But wait a minute, what was the psalmist doing in Psalm 137:9? He was rejoicing over the fall and destruction of Babylon. So what he was demonstrating was not a sub-Christian Old Testament ethic. He was demonstrating a Christian ethic that comes right out of the pages of the New Testament. The problem is not that the Old Testament has a sub-Christian ethic. The problem is that modern Christians have a sub-Christian ethic. The problem is that we don't value and love and desire the justice of God. Well, the New Testament in many places, such as the one just quoted, Revelation 18, either alludes to imprecatory psalms or quotes them directly, but not once does it criticize or censure either the author of the imprecatory psalm or the spirit in which he wrote it. Not once. Now, if it were sub-Christian, you'd think at least one time one of the New Testament authors would demonstrate a little bit of embarrassment over those imprecatory psalms. But not once does it happen. There may be those today who regard God's justice and judgment to be unfit subjects for the church's praise. Well, I say maybe. There certainly are those. In fact, one of the things that first got me to thinking, a bit of personal testimony here. One of the things that got me to thinking about the Psalms was this very fact. In the old Trinity hymnal, the blue one, not the red one, the red one's even worse yet, but in the old blue Trinity hymnal, if you look up in the topic index under either the justice of God or the judgment of God, the only references they have are to psalms. There are psalms in the Trinity hymnal. And under those topics of the justice of God or the judgment of God, you cannot find any uninspired hymnody. You cannot find where men are writing on that subject. Why not? And why is it that one of the key objections or one of the main objections against exclusive psalmody is that, well, then we would have to sing the imprecatory psalms? It's because men hate God's justice. They don't want to sing about it. It's certainly understandable that those who are the potential or actual objects of God's wrath would be of such an opinion. Why? Why don't they want to sing about the justice or judgment of God? Well, they don't want it falling on their heads. However, those who would be protected and comforted against God's enemies understand that the church is not saved by sudden and secret rapture from her enemies, but by the destruction of her enemies by God's powerful right arm. Therefore, a refusal to pray and sing against God's avowed enemies is tantamount to refusing to pray for the deliverance of Jerusalem and his people. And then I close the essay. Some of you will recognize this. Like fire that burns the woods, like flames of lightning, pursue them with thy storms and strike with fear. Fill up their faces with humiliation and let them seek thy name, Jehovah, then. Let them be terrified and shamed forever, and let them be dismayed and be destroyed. Let them know thou alone, thou art Jehovah, thou art the one most high over all the earth. Psalm 83, verses 14 to 18. Solvum Fac, right? And see, the name Solvum Fac doesn't mean sick 'em. It means save them. Right? Solvum Fac means do saving. Make a salvation.
Do salvation.
And the only way, though, that God does salvation is by destroying those that are troubling the church. So if we refuse to sing justice psalms, if we refuse to sing imprecatory psalms, we are refusing to sing about the deliverance of God. That's all I got. You wanted to say something? Sing something. You wanted to sing Psalm 83? Yeah, it's kind of hard to hear it without singing it, right? Psalm 83, in the back. What's the page?
356.
You have been listening to a sermon by Dr. Richard Bacon of Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed in Mesquite, Texas. For more information on FPCR Ministries, visit our website at www.fpcr.org or contact us by mail at 8301 Lakeview Parkway, Suite 111-164, Rowlett, Texas, 75088.